This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Exoneration has been incredibly important for those who oppose capital punishment. Since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976, 138 death row inmates have had their convictions overturned. Now, Building Bridges highlights the Jeffrey Descovich Foundation for Justice that came into being for the prevention and eradication of wrongful convictions as a result of its founder's own wrongful conviction for rape and murder at age 16.
At 33 years old, Jeff Descovich was exonerated and left prison with a mission to prevent what happened to him from happening to others. Deciding to work to prevent wrongful convictions and for the exoneration of those who have already suffered his fate. In studio with us, Jeff Descovich, founder of the Jeff Descovich Foundation for Justice.
Why don't we begin by your own experience that was that which led you eventually to this extraordinary and important foundation? What happened to you?
Yeah, at 16 years of age, I was arrested for the murder and rape of a high school classmate. My wrongful conviction was caused by a coerced false confession, which was extracted from me after many hours of interrogation, featuring threats, false promises, being driven to a county other than the one that I was familiar with. And basically, I got the third degree for about 7.5 hours with the tactics I just mentioned. Ultimately, I did give a coerced false confession using information which the police had given me in the course of their interrogation. My wrongful conviction also took place, as far as causes, aided by prosecutorial misconduct, fraud by the medical examiner, and an inept public defender. Fraud from the medical examiner came in because about 6 months before I went to trial, the results of a DNA test came in from the FBI lab, which showed that semen found in the victim didn't match. So rather than acknowledge they made a mistake, they instead continued to prosecute full speed ahead. The prosecutor elicited fraud on the part of the medical examiner because 6 months after doing the initial autopsy, it was only in response to the DNA not mentioning me that suddenly for the first time he claimed that he found medical evidence showing that the victim, a 15-year-old immigrant from Colombia, in the country for about a year and a half, leading a very sheltered life in which she never went out save accompanied by her older sister or her parents, that she was sexually active, which basically enabled the prosecutor to argue that it didn't matter that the seminal fluid didn't match me because it could have come from a consensual sexual encounter close enough to her murder and rape so as to explain away the DNA. The public defender I had was not very good. He didn't present my alibi evidence. He didn't explain to the jury the significance of the DNA excluding me. He didn't use it to argue that the so-called confession was coerced and false. He didn't explode the whole consensual sex fallacy proffered by the prosecutor. In fact, he never even asked the medical examiner that did the fraud a single question. So add it all up, I was wrongfully convicted. I lost all 7 of my appeals. I was turned down for parole. I had attempts at getting more sophisticated DNA testing rebuffed by former Westchester County District Attorney and New York State Attorney General candidate Jeanine Pirro. She blocked efforts at my getting further testing. Ultimately, I was cleared 16 years later because when she left office, I obtained representation from the Innocence Project. A different district attorney took office, and she allowed me to have more sophisticated testing.
Let me stop you for a moment and go back and just flesh out a few of the political implications of this as well. You had mentioned DNA. It's my understanding that actually, because the DNA was not dealt with at that time of your arrest, that later, that the person who was actually the perpetrator, whose DNA actually was there, went on to commit another murder. Is that the case?
Yes, the actual perpetrator left free, killed another woman 3.5 years later, a school teacher, mother of 2 in Peekskill, and it was only through that crime and being arrested for that crime that resulted in the DNA being taken from him and put into the data bank. So ultimately, 16 years later, from when I was originally convicted, when we got the further DNA testing and ran it through the data bank, it matched him. So I actually had to go beyond proving my own innocence, which the original DNA test really did, and I had to prove the guilt of the actual perpetrator.
Now, how are we to understand this confluence of circumstances, other than just outright corruption, that singled you out and was unrelenting in really constructing a case for your prosecution and incarceration? How do we understand that? What does that say systemically? What does it say about what you experienced? I mean, we are, of course, led to trust, and we see on TV all these wonderful CSI-type programs, the infallibility, if you will, of the systems of chemical analysis, of forensic analysis. But what really is going on that led to you being prosecuted and jailed for low these many years?
Well, they coerced a false confession. There's no law in New York State mandating that the police record the interrogations. So that enabled, A, the police to leave certain details out, i.e. the threats and false promises. The jury couldn't see I was coerced. So that's one aspect.
How did they coerce you?
They interrogated me for 7.5 hours. I mean, I was in a small room. They attached a polygraph machine to me. I wasn't given anything to eat the entire time I was there. The polygraphist himself was actually a Putnam County Sheriff's investigator who was pretending to be a civilian, so he never gave me my Miranda warnings. Basically, he gave me the third degree. I mean, he invaded my personal space. He raised his voice. He became more and more ferocious over the hours. And eventually, this officer who was pretending to be my friend, he came in the room and informed me that the other officers were going to harm me, that he was holding them off, that he couldn't do so indefinitely. I had to help myself. Look, just do what they want. They'll stop what they're doing. You're not going to be arrested. You'll go home afterwards. I mean, look, being young, naive, frightened. I was only 16 years old. And I wasn't thinking long term. I was just thinking about my own safety in the moment. Mm-hmm. And I made up a story based on information which they had given me in the course of their interrogation. I mean, by the police officer's own testimony, by the end of the interrogation, I was on the floor crying uncontrollably in what they described as a fetal position.
And you also mentioned that you had an alibi.
I had an alibi. I was actually playing wiffle ball at the time that the crime happened, but my public defender never sent anyone to talk to the alibi, and he never presented that alibi evidence.
And why do you think that was the case? Because that would seem to be so elementary for a defense attorney to do.
Well, not cross-examining the medical examiner. I look at, you know, he came to me and told me that, well, when we hadn't decided what type of jury, what type of fact finder we were going to use, it was going to be a bench trial or a jury trial. The judge went to him off the record and told him, pick a jury. I don't want to be responsible for finding your client not guilty. I mean, he never put that on the record either. How do I explain all these things? Mm. You know, I can't come up with any kind of a legitimate reason.
And in terms, I mean, this case has multiple causes that sent you to jail for unjust reasons. But how common is this on any number of cases that people are sent to jail unjustly?
It's much more common than what we think. I mean, across the country, there have been 300 DNA proven wrongful convictions. There's about three times that amount in terms of when you factor in non-DNA exonerations. I mean, considering that every time a junk science is exposed as such, every time a rogue police officer or expert is found to have been systematically committing perjury, dry labbing, one kind of corruption or another, when you think about all those things, I think that although the experts say, well, between 3% to 5%, I think it's higher than that. I mean, I knew 8 people who were wrongfully incarcerated and cleared before I was. I knew about 5 people afterwards. I think the real number is 15% to 20%.
Yeah, I would think higher. And I say this both just as a conscious person in this society, certainly as a legal aid lawyer, and of course it's reinforced by experiences such as yours, and indeed the very creation of the Innocence Project is documentation of that. So within that perhaps one of the questions, and I hope this isn't too personal or probative in a way, but I would be one angry person. I would be one angry person, and yet your demeanor, you do get out, and we'll find out a little bit more about how it came to be that you were finally exonerated, but I find it quite striking that you are self-contained enough, perhaps filled with yourself enough and have confidence not to be an angry and, frankly, rather destructive individual to yourself or others, given the longevity of your stay in prison for something that you certainly did not do. So how do we understand you and this enormous give back to others by the institution of this foundation of yours?
Well, I decided within a couple of days of my release that, you know, I wasn't going to be this angry, bitter person. I mean, I feel like I've lost so much already, and if I was to be angry and bitter, I would be losing even more. I think the system would have beaten me. I want to enjoy my life. I want to live a meaningful life, and I can't do that if I'm angry or bitter. You know, upon my release, I decided that, you know, I wanted to become an advocate. So I actualized that in a number of different ways as an individual. I mean, I did a lot of lectures across the country. I became a columnist for 5 years for a publication called the Westchester Guardian, where I wrote about wrongful conviction policy issues, exonerations, ongoing wrongful conviction cases, compensation cases. I lobbied a lot of elected officials in New York and Connecticut. I've testified at legislative hearings pertaining to wrongful conviction prevention legislation in New York and in Connecticut. I've traded privacy in exchange for media awareness on these issues, hoping that paves the way for preventative legislation. And you know, I've been part of the anti-death penalty struggle in New York and fighting off efforts at reinstating it. I was part of the campaign in Connecticut that repealed it. But I did those things as an individual. And about a year and a half ago, I was able to receive some financial compensation. I was able to settle some of my lawsuits. And it was at that point I wanted to take my advocacy work to the next level and have a foundation. So I committed $1.5 million of the money I received to start the foundation, not only continuing the awareness and the legislative aspect, but also doing things that I could never do as an individual, such as trying to clear people, and you know, both not just in DNA cases, but also in non-DNA cases, and then there's a reintegrative component. So I guess what I'm saying is I want what happened to me to count for something. I want to assist. I want to prevent this from happening to others, and to help them fix a situation if that's already happened. And I want them to have a smooth transition to society. So I can't forget about the people who I metaphorically left behind.
I know that you've been helping a number of specific individuals, but you're also fighting to change the process. You have a petition out there to change the process on any number of different points, one of which is how confessions are extracted by the police. So why don't we start with that and say what systematically is wrong with the process now and how that should be reformed?
Sure. We need to videotape interrogations from beginning to end. It would prevent police officers from leaving details out in their testimony. It would prevent a trial from coming down to a swearing contest between the police officer and the defendant, because you know which way that's going to go. Then also, beyond that, allowing false confession expert testimony into the courtroom. The experts don't give an opinion on a particular confession, whether it's authentic or not, but instead provide contextual information. What could lead to a person to falsely confess? Because the average person, probably even the average listener, thinks, well, only a guilty person would confess. But no, there's factors which lead people to falsely confess. And juveniles and people with mental health problems have been identified as particularly vulnerable populations. Having a pretrial hearing on the subject of a confession, where the subject matter would be whether a confession is accurate or not. Do the statements match up with the external evidence or not? Instead of simply having the hearing that we have now, which only considers voluntariness.
One of the things I just want to get back to before we continue on what Ken was where Ken was going, which is systemic reform. How did your exoneration come about? I know that you did work with the Innocence Project, and of course Barry Scheck and Russell Neufeld are really good friends, and the Innocence Project, we have an enormous respect for. It's just been phenomenal in what it's meant to reform within the criminal justice movement. And really the concept of restorative justice being implemented in our society. But your own specific story on exoneration.
Sure. Basically, I obtained legal representation from the Innocence Project. An advocate who I had an encounter with in the mail suggested that I write them. She lobbied them from outside their organization to take my case. That's investigator Claudia Whitman. Then also Maggie Taylor, who worked within the Innocence Project as one of the intake teams. She lobbied them from within the organization to take my case. So I had the two advocates working for me there with that. They agreed to take my case. Pirro left office. Her successor, District Attorney DeFiore, the Innocence Project approached her, and she allowed me to have further testing. So when they took the DNA, ran it through the data bank, it matched the actual perpetrator, Stephen Cunningham. And confronted with that evidence, he then admitted that he was the person who committed the crime. He also had confessed to a reporter on video camera, and he was my conviction was overturned. The conviction was dismissed on the grounds of actual innocence. He was arrested, pled guilty, and was sentenced for the crime. Hmm.
So given that your history in terms of overturning a conviction after having spent time in jail, what do we do not only to prevent people from being convicted, but of trying to get people out once they've been wrongfully convicted? And perhaps you could talk about a little bit about that in terms of reforming use of DNA evidence also, as was your case.
Yes, I think that the both, not just the prosecution, but the defense should also have equal access to the DNA data bank. You know, when I first tried to get more sophisticated testing, it should, you know, I tried to do that back in 1999, so I shouldn't have had to wait. It should have been an automatic thing. I mean, to me, there's nothing to lose by doing it. Either it's going to prove the guilt of the actual perpetrator, in which case guilt innocence is put to bed permanently, or it's going to prove that someone is innocent, in which case we can release them and turn in a police investigation towards getting the actual person. So equal access to DNA testing, of course, a standardized evidence preservation system. I mean, DNA is only around in 5-12% of all serious felony cases, but if you're lucky enough that your case falls with, even has DNA in it, the first obstacle is whether or not the evidence has been lost or destroyed. If either of those happen, then you would be unable to get testing.
Jeff, what are some of the other recommendations that you would like to see through your foundation and through general advocacy towards the reform of the criminal justice process?
I would like to see criminalization of clear-cut, intentional prosecutorial misconduct. When prosecutors engage in things such as suborning perjury, not correcting perjured testimony, withholding exculpatory material, working hand in glove with experts, tell me what you want to prove when I prove it, they've in effect pulled off a kidnapping under color of law. And when that leads to the wrongful conviction of a factually innocent person, there should be criminal penalties attached so that there's a deterrent. Not only is there no criminal deterrent, but there's no civil deterrent. You can't even sue them individually. I think that the immunity should be removed. I mean, the argument, oh, well, a prosecutor is an advocate and we want them to be able to do their job without fear of lawsuits, and this is why we have to have the immunity. I mean, to me, that's a fallacy. Police officers don't enjoy any such immunity. They're not stopped from doing their job. If you don't want to be sued, don't run over someone's constitutional rights. That's all it is. So aside from, and there's a lot of studies that show the prosecutorial misconduct is prevalent. It's with from the Pew Center to the USA Today to the Innocence Project to the North Carolina, I'm sorry, the Californian Innocence Project. There's many studies that show how pervasive prosecutorial misconduct is. And it's because there's no checks and balances. But moving away from that, because that's certainly not the whole picture, having a better system of public defense. I think that there should be one statewide system which would enable there to be oversight, quality control. We need to limit the caseloads. I mean, in the Bronx, for example, not far from the studio, it's not unusual for one defendant to be represented by for one attorney to represent 120 defendants at the same time. Mm-hmm. So limiting caseloads, making it an even playing field in terms of financial and human resources so that there's not this big disparity between the prosecutor's office and the public defender's office.
What about better funding?
we have to have better funding. Sure. I mean, the prosecutor has an almost unlimited budget to bring in experts. A public defender, to their very limited budget to get an expert. They got to ask the judge to allocate discretionary funding. The judges usually deny that. They want to keep the cost of trials down. So that's another huge step.
And I have to say that, you see, this is radio, so I have to tell you because you can't see it. But so many people fall under the spell of the optimism of Jeff. I mean, I actually met Jeff during the play The Exonerated, which if you ever have a chance to see and you haven't, go see. And he was speaking there. And I find what you're doing so important to the moral and social fabric, some restorative sensitivity in terms of criminal justice in our system, and your own experiences. We can't even begin to understand how traumatic and painful, and yet you have become so much the whole person. And all these women are here, actually, because they said they came here to, they're too shy, really. It's unfortunate. They don't want to speak, but they came here because actually Jeff does work with them, is helping them, and because they wanted to show their respect and support of him. So tell us a little bit about Eric Glisson.
Sure. Well, Eric Glisson served 17 years and 9 months. He was exonerated a little bit, actually formally exonerated, maybe about 3 weeks from now. As people may or may not know, when you're exonerated, you're released without anything. So
he was charged with a murder.
He was charged with a murder. He was cleared because two informants who were in federal witness protection program, they confessed to having committed the murder to which he was wrongfully
incarcerated. And spent 17 years inside.
Yeah, in fact, the federal investigators went to the precinct and said, look, we have this confession from informants, and you know, do you have any incident resembling this? And the police officers lied to the investigators, said, no, we don't. And so Mr. Glisson remained in prison.
That was in 2003 that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it took all these years.
Sure. So, you know, he was cleared. The foundation didn't clear him, but we were there to assist him upon his emergence from prison. So we've assisted him with an apartment. We've given him emergency funds, and we're in the process of helping him to find a job and just being a regular presence. You know, I really struggled a lot when I was released. There was nobody there. You know, it takes years for a lawsuit to be resolved and to have the support team. And so we've been a part of that. And in terms of how people assist. You know, I might have committed the money that I did to start the foundation, and I've given us a really good running start. But, you know, I can't sustain the foundation on my own indefinitely. We need to become sustainable through external funds. I mean, I've guaranteed, you know, 3 years. We're rapidly coming up on the close of 1 year. So we have 2 years in which to make this foundation sustainable. So people of, you know, large means can certainly, if they were a recognized not-for-profit agency, if they want to make a contribution, that certainly would help. People of average means, I mean, the president, say what you will about his politics, I'm not getting into that, but he raised $100 million with donations between ranging from 10 to 100. If we all do a little bit, we can accomplish a lot. But beyond that, not just individually, but maybe a listener works at a company that engages in corporate responsible citizenship, give back. So there's that aspect of it. Certainly coming on this, doing media opportunities that's such as the show, that's helpful. Maybe somebody has, I don't know, ties to one who could put a bug in someone's ear. There's a lot of different ways, even beyond the monetary aspect, that we can help the foundation. But definitely we need all the help we can get.
And I want to say before I ask how people can get in touch with you to close out, why do you think that this work, no matter what, is important in a democratic society?
I'm not going to get into prison reform. I know that, you know, but I mean, look, I'm an advocate of that. I mean, the test of any civilized society is the state of its prison. That's the famous quote. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, it's critical that, you know, only guilty people are arrested, convicted, and sent to prison as punishment, not innocent people. Not just you affect a person's life, but you send their family and their friends with them. You leave society at large in danger because the actual perpetrator is left free to strike again. You know, it's critical that the court system be accurate. And the purpose of my foundation, its importance, is that despite the Innocence Project and many other similar missioned organizations, there's no shortage of wrongful conviction cases. So there's, you know, it's not like there is a need, in other words, what I'm trying to say. And then most organizations only take on DNA cases. We do DNA and non-DNA. We have the reintegrative component. And that's the things which, you know, but those are the highlights of our foundation. That's the need for it. It's I can't sleep at night knowing that somebody is wrongfully imprisoned. They have a viable innocence claim. It could be proven if they but had someone to do boots on the ground investigative work. But yet, because there's no DNA there and the other organizations will only deal with DNA, they have to remain wrongfully imprisoned. I can't sleep doing that. That's why it's the need for the Jeffrey Deskwick Foundation for Justice.
Well, thank you for what
you are incredibly
you
impressive
do.
And doing incredible work.
Absolutely. I almost really. Can't wait to see. Not that it has to go that way, but I almost feel like there should be the honorary law degree because you got it. You've got the passion, you've got the intellect, and you've got the drive. But perhaps it's even more important, this foundation, because it replicates the work of a good criminal defense attorney in so many ways.
So lest we forget, how do people get in touch with you and also the address for your website?
Sure. The address of the website is www.thejeffreydeskwickfoundationforjustice. That is spelled the, TheJeffreyDeskwick, foundationforjustice.org. You can email us from the website. Also, there's our snail mail address. The Jeffrey Deskwick Foundation for Justice, 133 West 72nd Street, New York, New York, 10023.
And thanks to my sisters who are sitting back here for supporting Jeffrey and for the work they do. And perhaps we'll hear another time about their own cases, because there's issues there that the foundation is supporting as well. Jeffrey Deskwick, thank you for your sacrifice and for your commitment to law and social justice.
And keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.